My name is Alex Kanyi. I'm a tax partner at Cliff Decker Hofmeyer in our Nairobi office. On the 16th of May, we had discussions around the Finance Bill 2024. During the discussions, we had a very engaging panel. We had Asif Nurani joining us from Fatisa. He's an investment principal at Fatisa and he's worked at Fanisi Capital and IIP before, with over 10 years experience in terms of the PE and VC space, in terms of deal execution, exits, and all that. And he brought in a lot of conversations around what he thinks the implications of Finance Bill in the investment space. We also had Lydia Dirango join us from Equity Group. Lydia Dirango is the current group company secretary, and she's also the head of tax for the whole group. Lydia has held several senior management positions at EY and at KPMG. And with the Finance Bill bringing in a lot of implications, the financial services sector and then the insurance sector, Lydia will be speaking to us around what she thinks the Finance Bill will do to the banking sector and that insurance sector. Finally, we also have Lena Onyango joining us from CDH. She's a partner here as well. Lena brings a lot of experience, having worked with Viva Africa, having worked with Oraro and Company Advocates, and finally at ANL, where she was also a partner. She has a lot of experience in terms of tax dispute resolution, and she's worked with people in different sectors, from manufacturing to banking. And she also brings her perspective around what she thinks around this bill, and what kind of disputes might come up, and what she thinks should worry some of the people who are working in Kenya. Thank you. Enjoy the conversation. So we can start with you, Lydia. You know, Kenya economics performance strengthened in 2023 despite several challenges. We've been told about the GDP growth, you know, even by the World Bank, the IMFs of this world. In your view, is there a real growth in terms of GDP? And if there's one, what would you attribute this growth to?
Thank you, Alex, and good morning, everyone, once again. That's actually an interesting question. And for a person in the financial sector, how we really get to see if there's growth is how people perform in terms of when it comes to the repayments of their loan. And to the question of is there growth, what I can say is first, there's been a bit of stabilization of the Kenya shillings, which we can say it has helped in trade. And then secondly, when you look at where is the growth, there's an improvement in terms of how infrastructure has been done. And also from the private sector, the investment has still continued. And I can say Kenyans are resilient in terms of the environment is hard, but they're still resilient. When it comes to is it in the real economy and are the individuals feeling it? And what we've seen is that when it comes to people in their repayments of loan, there's a bit of struggle. There's a real struggle in terms of how people are doing in terms of repayment. And also the expenditure in the individual, the consumer markets, because what is being left actually to the individual for them to consume is limited. And I'm sure we saw, especially when the housing levy was introduced, people really complained. Because for a person who is an entrepreneur, at no point will you say, I will cover my employees, especially with the housing levy, because the economy is difficult. It's a difficult economic environment. So I can say for the GDP growth, in numbers, it's there, but to the real economy, people are still not feeling it. Thank you, Alex.
That's interesting because sometimes I was at an interview and the person who was conducting the interview asked one parliamentarian, you know, is there growth or improvement within the economy? And what this MP then said was that we have seen banks record high profits. We have seen other companies record very, very good returns. But the question that was asked to the MP was, what are your people telling you on the ground? And the MP quite struggled with that particular question. Anyway, moving on to you, Asif. You know, we see investors coming into the country with long-term to medium-term plans. You know, they look at the end game, not just now, but several years after. So, you know, you've been working within the PE investment space. And I'm just wondering, if you look at the tax environment in Kenya, do you think it is conducive enough in comparison to other emerging markets, or is there room for improvement?
No, I think there's definite room for improvement, and I think room for improvement may be a bit kind to use. I think we are starting, in my view anyway, starting to be a, to become fairly uncompetitive in our exports, in various things, and as Lydia was saying, you know, disposable income as well, because that's what drives the growth of the country. Consumer spending, apart from other things, but consumer spending is a big area of it. And the view that we take and the number of years that we look at, so we invest for, private equity and venture capital funds invest for 5 to 7, maybe even 8 years, but not longer than that. But we have to take a view of double that time, because we'd be investing and selling the business onto somebody else. And that person will probably take a 5 to 10 year view. So we need to basically take a 15 to 20 year view on a particular country, on a regime. So as you see these sort of inconsistencies in tax regimes, I mean, you can have high taxes. That's a different matter. So there are two matters. There's high taxes and there's inconsistency and volatility in tax regime. And that volatility in tax regime is even worse because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So it's like having, you know, currency depreciation, for example. So depreciating currency is bad, but consistently, you know, a currency that's consistently appreciating, then depreciating, and then appreciating again, makes you unable to plan. So the current regime, not only are the taxes increasing and they're high, but every day or every couple of months, there are new things, and you cannot plan your cash flow as business. And that's the same for investors, the same for businesses on the ground. You just are not able to plan, and that is even worse.
Interesting, especially when you say that when you're looking at a business, you're not just looking at it for your own interest. You're looking at exiting after the 7 years, but even thinking of this person who's coming to take on the business, what exactly are they going to find? And therefore you have also to think about, you know, a 14 to 15 years kind of plan when you're making the investment. That is quite interesting. And maybe to you, Lena, and sticking to that general theme of investment into the country, Kenya has for the longest said that we are, you know, highly ranked in terms of ease of doing business. But when you think about it with the taxes that we have, some may have a different view. You've seen Rwanda as an example, say we are number one in Africa in terms of ease of doing business. But when investors are looking at Rwanda as a market, they're saying the market is quite small. Do you think Kenya is losing its competitive advantage, or are we still good?
I will choose to be an agent of hope. I think Kenya is a competitive market. Not only do we have the resources, but we also do have the human capital for economic growth. However, there's a lot of things that go into consideration when I believe investors like ASIF and all these other international investors are looking at potential investment into the country, and tax is key, one of the key issues. For me, I feel the uncertainty and the constant change and the amendments that come in every year. 2023, you have this. 2024, it's been repealed. 2025, probably it's introduced, or maybe it's the rate is reviewed. So that level of uncertainty for me, I think, works against what we want to achieve as a country in terms of competing with the likes of Rwanda for foreign direct investments in Kenya. there's a tendency of comparing ourselves to the West. I mean, to be honest, we are not there yet. In terms of even the infrastructure, the social amenities that we have. My personal view is, I don't think Kenyans have a problem with paying taxes. I think it's the, would I call it apathy? We need to know we are paying this level of taxes, but how does that now translate into improving the lives of the normal mwananchi? So in terms of the public transport, education, social services, give us a high tax rate, but then let it translate also to giving me a sense of relief in my pocket in terms of having not to seek more expensive services from the government or the private sector. So yes, it is competitive. Yes, there's hope, but we need to have the difficult conversation of asking ourselves, if we continue like this, where are we driving ourselves? Are we on the quick race to the bottom?
Thank you. Thank you, Lena. Tax experts have been accused of being negative around the finance bill and perhaps not pointing some of the positive things that are within the bill. So maybe to you, Asif, is there anything positive in this bill, especially for investors? So that's the first question. And the other one is, if you are given the power to just remove one thing in this bill, what is it that you would remove?
Wow, positive. I think, I mean, I haven't been through the bill in detail, but there were a few things that Lena mentioned that were positive. There's a few positivities around, trying to improve sort of investments, or maybe bringing investments through digital and technology and things like that. But I haven't been through it in detail to really understand what the implications of those are. Right. What would I remove? I think one that was in the I think Lydia will speak to the financial services one. So I'll leave that aside. But the other one that was a little bit of a disappointment, a bit of a shock to me, was the standard rating of electric vehicles or anything to do with electric vehicles. This is a very nascent industry. A lot of money is going into it. We're becoming champions in Africa, at least, of fighting against climate change and moving towards renewable energies and moving towards electric vehicles and things like that. And we've seen a number of investments in that space, both bicycles and motorbikes and buses. Being that nascent, now immediately increasing it to standard rate, maybe started slowly, but immediately increasing it at this very nascent stage will just, hamper the growth of that industry, which is still very, very in its early stages. So I would say that is one that I would definitely remove.
And I think you're spot on, because that particular change was just done through Finance Act 2023, basically to introduce certain tax exemptions for people within the e-mobility sector. And I'm imagining that the investors then put in money on the promises that the government had given them. And then 1 year later, those incentives being proposed to be removed. So it would be interesting to see whether that will happen. And I wonder what kind of message then that communicates to an investor. But going on to you, Lydia, and Asif has just mentioned that there are some things around the financial services sector that are within this particular bill. We saw Equity Group record $43.7 billion profit after tax. And they cited notable growth in interest and other sources of income. But here you have the finance bill with certain measures, especially around standard rating of some of the things that banks do. What do you think will be the impact of these changes if they were to go ahead? So that's the first question. And the other question is there anything in the bill that would also affect the financial services sector, not just banks. It could be PSPs, you know, the M-Pesas of this world and etc. Thank you.
Thanks, Alex. And for this finance bill, it's an interesting finance bill, I'd say, because some of the aspects I've seen in the bill is it's a reaction to when I look at the past 1 year in terms of the interactions we've had with the Revenue Authority, be it through the associations or individually. Is it still on? So, and when you look at it, the first one, the fact that they've introduced VAT on financial services. A few years back in 2014, they introduced excess duty on financial services. And for banks, it was an uproar because we used to think excess duty is a sin tax, and it is what was put in the for the banks. And you'll see when you're looking at the contribution of financial sector for excess duty, we are even more than the people it was targeted for. Because for the financial sector, they actually contribute 60% of the excess duty actually collected comes from financial services. So it's become that it's a tax for the financial services. Then in addition to that, since I think they thought it has been successful in excess duty, let us do the same for VAT. What it actually means for the consumers is that for the financial services that somebody will be consuming, it's an increase of 39%. So whatever you'll be paying, there's an increase of cumulatively 39% increase, and it's purely tax. And it's 39% because now VAT will be also the excess duty that you pay, there is VAT on it. So that's why it ends up being 39%. It's going to really impact the industry because now somebody will think twice before they do a transaction. It's not the other way where you'd be like, oh yeah, you need this money, you just send. You're doing this? No. You will see a decline in terms of the financial service transaction because somebody will think twice. It's not going to be like the way it was in the past. And you'll see during COVID, people started, embraced the digital channels very much. And it really led to the growth and the expansion and people really being innovative of how will we do this transaction to make it easy. But with this, we will definitely see a slowdown. Then in addition to that, when I look at the insurance space where we also play in, the introduction of the motor vehicle tax is also a punitive thing. Insurance penetration right now in the market is at 3%. And it has not, we are barely started. So the minute that you actually introduce a motor vehicle tax and you're putting it at 2.5%, and even for those people in the commercial space where they have commercial vehicle, they already have the advanced tax. Yes, thank you. They already have the advanced tax. So advanced tax, motor vehicle tax, then you tell them they must take full insurance. It's killing the insurance sector because now how do we now, if I'm a person who is in the business of even logistics and I have all those motor vehicles and you're telling me in addition to that I have to pay this motor vehicle tax, it's going to be actually a difficult task for somebody. And somebody will ask themselves, how do we do this? Then the third one that has really disturbed me is the one for data protection. So, and for that data protection also, there's a section in the bill which actually provides for where they want integration. So that with a person who's a data processor, for example, they want integration, direct integration with somebody in the financial sector because they're a data processor. So right now what happens is that whenever, let's say they need information for a customer, they would definitely write a specific letter and say, we need this information for this person so that now we engage on one-on-one for a particular customer. What they're actually now requesting is for full access, which for me, I think is not the right way to go. Because ideally, if you're looking at a particular taxpayer, then it makes sense where you're requesting for that particular information. But this one of saying they want exemption based on the Data Protection Act, for me, I think that's overreaching. And it will actually make people move away where we've made so much strides in the financial inclusion space. So it's something that really needs to be rethought.
Thanks for those comments. And quite worrying, especially from a data protection angle. If, for example, and I think I've seen this also being raised by lawyers to say, you have this privacy or, you know, which is guaranteed in common law when matters are being dealt with between client and advocates. And one of the questions that is being asked is, with this change in the Data Protection Act, will it mean that KRA will then say that we need certain information from you as a lawyer because you want to collect tax, and you won't be able to then say this information is protected by client-lawyer privilege? So it's an interesting space that we're also watching to see what will happen in that regard. So, and I don't know whether, Lena, you have some comments around this data protection. You have the right to privacy under the Constitution. On the other side, people have been telling KRA, there's a lot of information outside there which you're not using to collect tax. And that's what is informing what KRA is trying to do to access information. How do you balance this between the right to privacy vis-a-vis access to KRA to collect information? And could we achieve a balance at all?
I think rights that are enshrined in the Constitution are non-negotiable. If I have a right of privacy, KRA's mandate or in the exercise of their mandate in terms of tax collection cannot supersede that constitutional right that I have under the Constitution. So for me, I feel it's a very sticky area. And I think that KRA, instead of just looking for a blanket exemption from aligning with the Constitution and then not having to operate within the ambit of the Data Protection Act, I believe there are ways of collecting this information that they are looking for. I mean, at the moment, for instance, in certain VAT disputes, we realize that they go to a supplier or a customer, and they're able to connect the dots, and you know, they will be able to tell that Lydia supplied Alex a certain amount. So it does not, would be wrong to say that they're not able to get this information through other vehicles or through other means. But they should not try and infringe on the rights of Kenyans and now involve the rest of us, lawyers, accountants. We have accountants in the room, situation like Lydia, you know, they have so much information about transactions by their clients, and now being forced to release this information, I think it will open a can of worms that we'll not be able to put the worms back in. So I feel it's a very sticky position. KRA should get creative in terms of how they want to collect this information. I don't know, a learned colleague, perhaps I can override the moderator. What is the situation in Uganda? Is it the same thing as the URA? Can they access information that is considered private? Uganda. And we seem to be borrowing a lot from our neighbors. So we might as well follow them on that one. So I think let us uphold rights and you know, that are enshrined in the Constitution. Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is Kenya is leading the way in terms of privacy and data protection, and perhaps leading the way downwards, as someone is pointing to me. Anyway, moving on swiftly, I want you to prepare yourself to ask questions to the panel. So we'll do that shortly. But before we get to that, yesterday the president said that our tax to GDP ratio is very low at about 14%. And he says in his regime, he'll ensure that this moves to 22%. I just want to get general comments about that. starting with you, Lydia, coming this way.
For me, I believe he needs to close the loop. Increase it, find the GDP to tax ratio to 25%, but give the service. Because, you know, the one tax that we always forget is the, do we call it the African tax? It's
Black tax,
yes. It is there and it is so real. And why do we do it? We actually do it because the government is not giving the service. If we had service, we would actually not be paying it. Because now you find that we are gathering ourselves, contributing for somebody who is unwell, gathering ourselves in order to bury somebody. Ideally, if these services were availed by the government, we would actually not be having those problems. And then also, when it comes to the influx, where everybody in the middle class is saying, no, my child has to go to a private school, that's additional money that we could be putting for other things if the public schools were actually working. Because when you look back, I'm sure majority in the room back in the days went to a public primary, public high school. So if we can have the service, I don't think people would mind to pay the tax as long as they're seeing value for money. So the loop has to be closed.
I think, and mine is, it needs to be researched a bit more, and I must admit it's a little bit theoretical, but I think that we are ending up, and this is over the last few years, consistently how it's been and how it looks like it's going, is we are taxing the same people more, right? So we're not increasing necessarily the tax umbrella or people under the tax umbrella. We are putting the motor vehicle tax. Already those businesses are paying the corporate tax. They're paying, you know, the employees are paying PAYE. Now those employees and the employer are paying housing levy, increased SHIF, and now the motor vehicle tax and all of that. And it's the same consumer that's paying more, right? So not only that, then the actual tax rates or bans have also increased, right, to from 30% up to 35% for high-income earners. So you that employee, and mostly if you look at where the taxes are coming from, it's from these corporates that are now being, in my view, being overtaxed. And the employee who's feeling a very heavy burden of tax. And it depends then on where the GDP is growing. So over the last few years, has the GDP been growing because of increasing formalized businesses and formalized sector, or more informal sectors? And the informal sector, so you know, the whole you know, public transportation, the way it looks, the whole border sector and all of that, there's significant growth in those areas. And those are not being effectively taxed, right? So where the GDP is growing needs to be looked at. And what we might ended up doing is saying, yes, the GDP has grown and the GDP to tax ratio has come down or has reduced. But then in what areas is the GDP growing? And then are we taxing those areas sufficiently? Or are we putting the same or increased burden on those that are already taxed? And if you do that, you will never reach 22%, because then you will kill those businesses, and you know, you will in fact effectively even reduce the tax to GDP, you know, GDP to tax ratio. So I think that needs to be carefully looked at, and then economists in the room we learned about this thing about called the Laffer curve. About the syntax. So at some point, the more, up to a particular point, the more you tax a particular product, the more you increase the revenue. But at some point, there's an inflection. And then as you tax it more, now the tax revenue reduces. And I think we might end up seeing something like that.
What do you think about this tax to GDP ratio that our president is talking about?
I believe the justification for it was also he was of the view that we are highly in debt, would be a bankrupt country. And I think for me, one, I'm yet to see a country that has taxed itself to success. I think the government should take a wholesome approach. I think Lydia and Asif have intimated to this. While on one hand, you're introducing new taxes to put more money in Kenyans' pockets and giving them reliefs and deductions in employment income, on the other hand, you're raising VAT on services. So it's take from this side, give on this side. So there's that balance in terms of, one, how do we make or improve the lives of Kenyans? Two, how do we account for this high tax that we now want to collect to make Kenyans want to pay higher taxes? And then how do we control day-to-day government operation costs, probably borrow less? So I'm looking at it from a perspective of there's a lot of factors that come into play. And tax, as Asifa said, is not necessarily the solution or the savior of the situation that we find ourselves in as a country. I think it takes, there's a lot that comes into play, and the government should now probably engage stakeholders in different sectors, drive foreign investments, improve social amenities, infrastructure, encourage the growth of businesses in Kenya. We have companies that are leaving Kenya for Rwanda, Ethiopia, Tanzania. Just create a conducive environment for people to want to come in. And then when on a tax perspective, give people a level of certainty that I'm going to invest $1 billion. This is the tax implication I'm looking at. For instance, the electronic vehicles. Someone invested. They're not just going to pull out after 12 months, but now they have to make do with these new taxes that probably they had not foreseen or they had not planned for. And of course, will impact, have an adverse effect on their businesses. So I wish and I hope that as a government, they take a wholesome approach. It's not about the numbers, but it's about all these other factors that come into play to get us to where we want to be as a country.
Thanks for that. With that, we want to now bring this mic to your side. Just to check if you have any questions for the panel.
Thank you, all of you, the panelists. I think we need to give them a big clap because you have really addressed all the pertinent thoughts that we all have in our mind. And the main one being that the government is actually not thinking straight by putting all these taxations through to us. We as a company, just to give you a bit of a brief, as we all know, last year was one of the, and I've been in the trucking industry for 37 years, okay? And I've never seen a worst year in my life than last year. We were hoping with a bit of a macroeconomic conditions, getting better with the strengthening of the Kenya shilling and with the fuel prices coming down, that we would see a better 2024. But when you look at the finance bill, you see it's getting tough again. I'm part of the FKE board, and we had AGM 2 weeks ago in Nakuru. I come from Nakuru, from the Rift Valley chapter. And the key message from the FKE chair lady, Jacqueline Muga, was, and for all of us, is survive and sustain in 2024. So if employers are struggling, where does the government want to take us? Like you, Asif, said that they're about to kill the goose that is laying the golden eggs because they're taxing us so much. We're like a punda, you keep on putting more in our bags and eventually we give up. We haven't bought a new truck in the last 2 years. There's no justification, okay? We are trying and we are already setting up in Tanzania because we are finding the business atmosphere in Kenya not at all investor friendly, okay? So just coming to one or two things here in the current finance bill, I think our government also has a bit of an amnesia. They have forgotten that the road license or the motor vehicle tax was, we used to pay licenses about 20 years ago. Then it was put, they said we'll abolish the licenses, we'll put it on the fuel as part of the road tax levy, okay? We are already paying a road tax levy and now they're coming back with a motor vehicle tax of 2.5%. And like you said, how are they going to manage it? So you've got out of say 100 vehicles that are insured, I would say 50 plus are on third party cover, okay? How do you determine the value for that? You have a flat fee that you pay, right? And like you said, all the taxes that the government wants from us have got to be paid within a timeline. And where is the cash flow? We are paying VAT before we are even receiving a single penny for any one of our suppliers in the formal industry, right? So we've got to address a lot of issues. I think the government should not take out any policies from the back pocket. Somebody wakes up in the morning and thinks, this is, I have a V's in the system and let me just try and get some money from this, this sector or whatever. But they're not thinking straight. They really need to have, I think, a board of economists, etc., because no country has ever prospered on the back of high taxes. We are reducing consumption. As consumption is reduced, the wheels of the economies tend to start grinding, okay? And that is where we are heading. And it is really, really sad that it's such a beautiful country, such a resilient country, such a hardworking country with a fantastic human capital, the government is resorting us going down here. And that's what I feel. So I think going forward, we just hope, like we live in hope, like you said, Lena, and we hope and we see that we continue to survive and sustain and hope that sense prevails and they don't bring so many punitive measures into place and some of them are shot down. Thank you.
Thank you so much, panelists, for this very edifying discussion that you've given. Why I've enjoyed your presentation is the fact that I've had the vantage view of listening to what Kenya is doing vis-a-vis what is happening in my motherland, Uganda. What I note out of all this is that I think countries in East Africa are speaking to each other, and their strategy is that for as long as I'm not the only country that is looking bad, we can afford to make the tax regime as bad as it is. And that is why I've been thinking, I think from a tax lobby perspective, Kenya should lead the way. Kenya being the gateway to East African investments should lead the way in coordinating tax lobbying to work across the entire East African region. Why am I saying that? You're already complaining that the PAYE you're paying is very high. In Uganda, I pay PAYE at the rate of 40%. So if Kenya increases it to 35, what will the politicians tell you? But Uganda is paying at 40%. Why are you complaining about 35? Yet, if these issues were being approached, all of us in the region as a whole, we would probably have an opportunity of dealing and addressing those issues together. Then recently, about 2 years ago, because Kenya Revenue Authority has been hitting targets, and Uganda Revenue Authority got wind of that fact that Kenya is doing very well. So what did they do? They came and hired a very good Kenyan to be the consultant for Uganda Revenue Authority. And when he goes to Uganda, what did he do? Same blueprint. Paramilitary, those young boys go impound traders' items that do not have ETIMs or the equivalent of IFRIS. And last week, but one, we had a trader's strike across the entire Uganda over the same issues. And then also what I am noting, which fact we cannot discount and downplay, and which we've got to tackle together as a region, is IMF seems to be quite influential in tax policy. And what I note lately, I think Kenya is the best ally of IMF. You're cozier to IMF than us in Uganda because of some of the laws we've passed. We are not very friendly to them anymore. So IMF is against zero rating and tax exemptions. And the question which we normally ask, when you go in the Western world, is all income in the Western world taxable? And there are exemptions, zero rating, or even zero rating. So all the things, I mean, I noted all the exemptions and the zero rating, which have come through here. Of course, for us, bread has always been standard rated. But all these items where zero rating has been removed, Uganda has done the same. So I think we need to work together as a region, especially the multinationals, or even as consultants, if you think you're going to confront tax regime changes unilaterally as a country, you're not. Just like I remembered, you know, the other day we were saying, let VAT rate be reduced. That's what the traders were saying. The VAT rate in Uganda is 18%. The traders were saying, let us reduce it to 16% so that we mirror Kenya. But I think sometime back, I also heard voices that Kenya wanted to harmonize it with the rest of the region so that they increase it to about 18% as the rest of the region. Yet, if we were speaking together, we could find another way of dealing with it. Now, lastly, on the financial services side, you're complaining that there's excise duty on transfer services. I think let me give you some little secret. I know Kenya, you're going to borrow because you seem to have the appetite for taxing lately. For us in Uganda, we do not only tax services on transfer of money, but we've also gone a notch higher to tax the money itself, which is being transferred. At the rate of 0.5%, except banks. And what we keep telling the banks, do not laugh at the mobile money transfers or even the waves of this world, because anytime they're going to come for you. So Kenya, I put you on notice that the money you're transferring sooner than later may also be subjected to tax. Thank you so much, panelists.
I think those were good comments. I haven't had any question yet, but I don't know. Do you have questions? I think that table, Regina.
First off, wanted to thank the panelists. That was a brilliant, brilliant discussion. But from where I sit, having been in the profit sector and as in the excisable manufacturer sector, it's pretty sad to see how that industry is being hit hard. 5 days of, you know, making payment on taxes is difficult, especially looking at the volumes that they churn out on a daily basis. But besides that, I'm currently now in the NPO sector, and it saddens me that financial services are becoming more expensive. Right now, a number of people are unbankable, you know? And in my sector, we are trying to reach out to those who are unbankable. And it's very frustrating that the work that we are doing seems to be undone, you know, at the same time by the same government. And it seems the targets that we had of having women and especially young persons become more financially free, I don't see that happening anytime soon. That's unfortunate. But my question is to Lena on APA. It's a welcome move that we have APAs from the income tax perspective. But I feel there's still an element that has not been incorporated in that regard in terms of the change. So in terms of imported goods, especially where you have related parties, what happens to the customs aspect? Because on one hand, you'd be having the advantage of having an APA and discussing it with the domestic taxes department, but then it becomes an issue with the customs side. So I think that's a proposal that you may consider having, because that element has not been factored in. I think that would be my biggest question. The other points were actually discussed, especially on the LAFA curve. Thank you.
Thank you for these very excellent deliberations. I want to talk, maybe mine is more of a comment. We employ over 900 employees. Now, one of the challenges that we've seen is with the new statutory guidelines, that is really a game changer for us. Particularly, I worry about the young people coming into looking for employment, because as an employer, that is where we will first take action. And therefore, if you've got a young market where people are coming in with very low levels of skills, and that's where they're able to get an opportunity to build a career, build up skills, that opportunity with the new statutory deductions is completely closing that window. And therefore, employers like ourselves are already looking for alternative solutions for those roles and those support and shared services. And that is not just limited to my sector, but when I talk to other peers who have been in business as long as us, that is what they're looking for. You then have the issue of younger businesses or smaller businesses that cannot comply. And therefore, then you get into illegal employment activities where I, as an employer, will recruit you, but I'll not offer you an employment letter. So therefore, you can't go to Lydia and get a loan to help you move up the economic ladder. And therefore, then you have employment injustice. Now, so I think we need as a country to really think through, because I think the population of those who are under 29 is it close to 70 or 80% in this country? Where are they going to find an opportunity to move up and evolve themselves?
Wait, so there's a question for you, Lena, around, and thank you for those comments. In fact, before we go to the question, it looks like, I don't know, for some of us who did, was it cost accounting where we're doing last in, first out? If what he's explaining to me perhaps looks like the youngest in will be the first out. Anyway, to advance pricing agreements and customs, what are your thoughts?
Alex, we are hopeful. We are staying hopeful. Regina, on the APAs, so the spirit behind APAs is mainly illicit financial flows, meaning it's the income tax aspect of it. So basically, it's to mitigate or reduce the amount of funding or finances that are moved from Kenya, which is probably a high tax jurisdiction, to now a lower tax jurisdiction. Now, it's separate or a different issue when it comes to now customs duty on the imports. So APAs are more on the income tax side of it. Customs duty being an indirect tax is a different animal altogether. But I think what the conversation should be now moving from now the EAC perspective, the AFCTA perspective, you know, trading between the African countries or importations and customs reliefs on inter-African trade. Maybe now that is the conversation that should be advanced. And I'm glad that there's the suggestion that, you know, even for these tax policies, we should look at it not just from a Kenyan perspective, but we can even now start looking at it from a regional or EAC perspective. So APAs would not necessarily be instrumental on customs duty issues, but they're basically mitigating factors for income tax perspective. I hope I've addressed your question. Yeah. So,
Regina, I've gone through what you're actually saying, where the APAs, it will be very good that if the customs authority would actually be respecting it, because you've already done your documentation, you have your justification for the prices, but then when it comes to you're actually importing the actual good, they refuse and they don't even respect the transfer pricing document that you actually have. So it's a real challenge, and I do agree with you that if when they are giving the provision for the APA, ideally at the same time, they need to introduce the respecting of the APA in the customs rules so that now there's end-to-end where you've done an exercise, it's an expensive exercise you've done, because negotiating the APA, best case scenario, it will take you 2 years. And then after all that negotiation, you bring the item that you're bringing and then only for it to be frozen at the entry point and being asked to top up the taxes because they don't respect the APA that you've entered in with the domestic taxes. So there's need to be conversation between those two lines so that now whenever you've prepared your APA, it's thoroughly respected when you're bringing in the good. I agree with you.
Great. Yeah, I was just remembering that you did quite a study on advance pricing agreements. So you're a guru on this. And I was hoping that you'd also comment on it. We are coming to an end of the panel discussion. If you look at your timetable, just right on time again. I wanted to check if there are any questions before we wrap up.
Morning. Now, I have a question on the housing levy. I remember the previous levy was scrapped off as being unconstitutional. How is it different? How is the current law different, the current act different from the previous one? And as far as the litigation is concerned, had there were several cases about it. Maybe can you advise us what's the progress? And is there a hope that this thing will be scrapped off? Because personally, I think what we have right now, especially for us who are in employment, now you have SHIF. SHIF for me is a form of tax. It's basically not an insurance product. So I'm thinking, for example, if I earn 100,000, that amount is being subjected to 2.5. And that same amount is being subjected to 1.5. That same amount is being subjected to POI. And it's not being reduced such that, for example, you find that the 100,000, you deduct the 2.5, then you are taxed on that 35%, then you get the net of that. So you find that if I have a salary of 100,000, it's being subjected to several taxes on the same amount, so that you find that it's, for me, it feels a bit punitive, and I don't know what is your comment on that one, because I think probably the government needs to seriously look at that, because I don't think from the comment that from the president, what the president was saying is that he's going to move the tax to GDP ratio from 14 to 22. I think for a layman. In fact, when that comment came out in the media, it was not talking about tax to GDP ratio. It was talking about 14 to 22. So when somebody reads, somebody who have no idea about what that means is trying to understand what does it mean. I'm already being taxed at that 5%, but it seems as if the tax seems to be lower. So when that comment came out, I think we got a bit confused. And if it's coming from the president, shows that we are going to have more chaos in 2025 and going forward in 2027. Actually, for me, I don't think it's even, we call it unpredictable. You call it a chaotic tax environment because we actually don't know what is going to happen. Yeah, so, and especially for those of us who are in employment. So I don't know, maybe you can talk more about that.
And it's very interesting. So when it was first introduced, this housing levy, within Finance Bill 2023. It was introduced as a levy. There was even a cap in terms of how much an employer and employee would contribute, giving a maximum of 5,000 shillings. And then also within it, there are a lot of stories around how people would own houses and qualify for the houses. There was also speak of if you don't qualify for a house, then your money is put into some form of investment, and then you're given some form of return because you don't qualify for the house. So that was the drafting within Finance Bill 2023. Then we went to Parliament. I was part of the team that were making submissions to Parliament to tell them, we don't like this housing levy. And you guys, while you're calling it a levy, we see it as tax. And we highlighted, you know, our frustrations around the drafting, as it were. And what then the MPs decided to do, and after a lot of, frustrations and a lot of complaining from the public, they said, okay, this thing is a tax. And it was more like, okay, do what you'll do. This thing is a tax, and you guys will have to pay it, and we have this ambitious plan to build houses. So then it was challenged at the High Court and went on up to the Court of Appeal. And at the High Court, they looked at the drafting of Finance Act 2023, and in particular, the provisions for housing levy. And the High Court said, as drafted, it was unconstitutional. Well done. Then they moved to the Court of Appeal to say, the High Court has decided that this thing is unconstitutional, government then asked the Court of Appeal to reverse that particular decision so that they were able to continue collecting the housing levy. And the Court of Appeal was dealing with two issues. One was a preliminary application to say that, to stay the judgment of the High Court, which had declared housing levy as unconstitutional, which the Court of Appeal declined and say we will not stay that. And then and said the appeal will continue, the substantive appeal will continue at the Court of Appeal. So what happened after is then the introduction of the Affordable Housing Bill. This government is quite clever. So they say, okay, fine, let's park that particular provision of the Finance Act that is in court. Whatever they will decide, they will decide. Whatever time they will decide. But government looked at it and said, okay, we don't have the luxury of time and we need to collect this money even as that appeal continues at the Court of Appeal. And what they did is then introduce a new law, which is the Affordable Housing Bill, on to being approved as the Affordable Housing Act and is now in force. And that's the reason why they are still collecting affordable housing levy through the Affordable Housing Act, not the Finance Act 2023. So we'll still wait to see what will be decided finally by courts. So you have two cases, basically. You have one case challenging housing levy as drafted under Finance Act, and you have another dispute in court challenging the housing levy as provided in the Affordable Housing Act. But I'm not too optimistic in terms of the final outcomes, if I may just add. Good. I see we don't have any further questions from the participants. Any question before we wrap it up? Okay, one final question.
My question would be on the NSSF. I remember there was a litigation on the same, and it seems as if there was no clear direction whether we are going back to 200 or we are going to 2160 or we are going to remain to 1080. And I could see write-ups from different law firms. Some of them are saying that we need to go back to 200. Others are saying we need to follow up with the new rates as gazetted by the government. Maybe can you comment on that if possible?
I believe it was at the High Court where there was a petition to say that the NSSF Act and particularly the contributions therein were unconstitutional, especially the changes that were made to increase the rates. And then at the High Court, what they then decided is that it's about jurisdiction of the court and saying that the ELC did not have jurisdiction to listen to that particular case by NSSF, and basically threw out the case on the basis of technicality to say that since they did not have any jurisdiction, the rates that, okay, the law as was drafted for NSSF was proper, and meaning that then you and I would have to contribute the higher contributions for NSSF. So when it went to the Court of Appeal, the Court of Appeal said that we've looked at the judgment and you guys at the High Court, you're wrong in terms of saying that you don't have jurisdiction. So we've taken the matter back to you to listen to it and determine it on the basis of the merits of the case. So that's the current status. Which brings in then the confusion. If the High Court said that they did not have jurisdiction, and for that reason the NSSF said that they had won and therefore wanted to collect more taxes, and here you are, the case has been taken back to that same court. So do you go by the NSSF route to say we can collect more from Kenyans? Or do you go by the employer or the employees who now say that this High Court actually has jurisdiction and we should give it time to first make a decision
before we go to those high NSSF rates. So there's been a little bit of controversy and uncertainty around then what position you should take. And my advice would be you should take legal advice as an organization on what that decision means, especially for guys who are employing very huge numbers for employees. I think you should take legal advice on that particular position. Good. I think we've come to the end. Lena, I just wanted to comment on SHIF and whether there's still housing relief and whether that is advantageous to an employee or not. Maybe you could mention something.
I think just a follow-up on the housing. The proposed amendment is now it will no longer be a relief, but it will be an allowable deduction from your income, which might actually be beneficial. So let's see how that will roll out when the act finally comes out. But that's the change that's proposed in the finance bill.
Okay. Francis, you want to give closing remarks? Okay, Francis has a question, and then we'll give it up to Stella for closing remarks.
As you spoke, there's one side that we don't consider, which is the employer, because it's deducted from us, but the employer has to match. And that's very painful when you're dealing with investors. And surely our credibility is also on the line as a country, because nobody is thinking about the multiplier effect to the employer, to the investor, because yes, I'm Kenyan. I don't mind so much contributing, but when you ask also the employer to contribute, the 1.5, the 2.5, then that means as a consumer, if you have a product, price have to go up. So we are not closing the loop, which is quite unfortunate. It is where we are. And that's why the multiply effect of the decisions we're making now, we've not yet felt them. As individuals, yes. As employers, we have to balance between employing more people and surviving. So the survive and sustain is real. We have to reduce manpower. Unfortunately, crime will go up. So that's the loop that you're not looking at when we propose. And as we feel these issues, as employers, we're also thinking about cutting manpower and all that. So it's a hard times ahead. And really, when you think about your impact, also think about the person paying the check and how they feel about these taxes. So thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Lydia. Thank you, Asif. Thank you, Lena, for accepting to moderate, to participate in the panel, and for your useful insights.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.